It is 1:10, and we do have a substitution on the board for Office of Legislative Legal.
Julie Pellegrin, Office of Legislative Legal Services.
All right. The next item on the agenda is number 2017-2018, number 66, limit on local housing growth. If the proponents could come forward and just state your names and...
Dan Hayes.
Julianne Page.
Okay. And do you want to just begin by telling us what you believe the single subject of your measure is?
What the single subject is?
Yes.
It's just housing growth on a countywide basis.
Okay. Any questions from the board on single subject?
No.
Is there anybody signed up on this? No. No. Okay. Any discussion by the board? This is similar to the question we had last year, except it's statutory and not constitutional. So.
Yeah, just if the proponents could confirm, I think maybe it was measure number 4 when it was originally proposed as a constitutional change. Is the only change that this is a proposed statutory change instead of a constitutional change?
There's some language, quite a bit of language dropped about details for city clerks and county clerks and that kind of thing. That was all dropped, so.
And then the definitions were also moved.
The definitions were moved to the top.
Okay.
So, yeah, I complied with all the changes that the... So when I sent it back through Legislative Council, they sent me a letter that they didn't need to look at it.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. Want to make a motion?
Sure. I move that we find that as to initiative number 66, it constitutes a single subject and we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to the proposed ballot language. Do you have any comment on it? Okay. Again, it's similar. Well, it might be exact, except for the statute, to what we set last time, which was approved by the court. So I don't have anything new unless anybody else has.
I don't either. And I checked, and it is, I think it is word for word, except
yeah,
at the beginning there.
I had some ideas for possibly shortening it, but if it's already been approved from the court by the court, I'm not sure it's worth it.
Is there anybody wants to speak on the title? No. All right. Then.
Okay. I move that we set title for initiative number 66, consistent with the staff draft and as shown on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right, that takes us to proposed initiative 2017-2018, number 83. Hope you didn't put too much in that meter. All right, so 83, state income tax. You guys want to come up and just introduce yourselves and...
I'm Marty Nielsen, co-proponent.
Mike Spaulding, co-proponent.
Right. And do you want to just start out telling us what you believe the single subject of your measure is and then maybe go through any changes from the prior iterations we've seen?
So it is state income tax. It's identical to number 62, except that it's less. Paragraph 4 has been eliminated, which was a 12-year reduction in the income tax rate.
And is it your intent to only circulate one of these?
Yes, we're doing polling right now and looking at funding, so we're not sure which one's going to get the most support.
Okay,
so
but
I appreciate you
don't intend to circulate multiple petitions for signature? No.
Too expensive.
Okay. All right. Any questions from the board? Anybody who wishes to speak on? No? All right. Make a motion.
Sure. I move that as to initiative number 83, we find that it contains a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to settle a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right, that takes us to the draft language. Do you have any comments on the draft?
Since we put quite a bit of effort into this, I would like to suggest that we use the text that we just came up with earlier for 62 and just strike or modify the part referring to the tax reduction. I think we still have a 0.03% reduction.
So I think the one difference we would need, Stephen, is the, that, and then also instead of 4.63 to 4, it would be 4.63 to 4.6.
All right. Any other?
I'd just like to have my co-proponent here bring this up. And that is the issue of spending so much time describing the method the state will use to calculate the income tax credit.
Thank you. The words in here, the income tax credit is going to appear on the tax return. The taxpayer, average taxpayer, has no idea what all of these issues are that are in this verbiage. I'm sure it's confusing to the average taxpayer to read all that because they don't know what all those things are. The number is going to appear on the tax return. They have no input into the calculation, and so I would ask that it get removed.
I guess I'll comment on that. Even if that's true, that the average voter, they're just going to see a number, I think in proposing the initiative and in us fulfilling our duty of describing what the measure does, it's important for us to make clear what is going to change as far as the income tax credit. I think in this language crafted here, we've tried to do our best to explain it in a clear and simple way as to what numbers are going to be added together to come up with that ultimate calculation. I guess to my way of thinking, it's important that we have that description in here so that voters can understand where that number is coming from, even if on their form they're just going to see the single number.
I would agree with that. I think even if a voter doesn't understand what each one of those things are, listing them out gives them at least an idea of what the magnitude of the tax credit may be, what all's being included when they go to calculate it. So I think it's helpful to have it.
And some of it's a little pejorative. We think the last component, state revenue retained as authorized by state voters in 2005, number 7, that's not language in our initiative. And the authorized by state voters kind of indicates that we're going against the will of the state voters. Well, everything here was done by state voters or their representatives, so I don't know why we have to call that out and try and make it look like we're overcoming previous will of the voters.
I think the measure refers to referendum C, is that?
Correct. our measure does not, but it's actually certain excess retained revenues or something like that.
So the draft I'm looking at of number 83 says, listing the items, it says, and all excess revenue retained by use of referendum C.
Yeah, my mistake. I was looking at a preferred title, not at the...
Okay. And I think rather than... And this is just my opinion. I think it's important to include that in the list of items. And rather than using referendum C, which may be more confusing, it's I think it's intended to be descriptive, not pejorative, in just referencing that it's the retention that was authorized by the voters. I don't know that that I don't view that as language that is trying to discourage voters. I think it's just describing an element that would be included in the income tax credit.
And you couldn't just say revenue retained since 2005, or it's hard to describe it.
Right. I agree. I think the most clear way to refer to it is the way it's written.
And I probably wouldn't put any of it in, but that discussion sailed last time, so.
Well, I know, but it's worth another look.
What do you think?
So I would move that we adopt the changes that are shown on lines 2 and 3.
Actually, do we need to move to adopt, since this is also different from the staff draft in other ways, because we made the changes we made on 66, do we need to indicate that as well?
Well, I was just going to read it, and then we could just adopt the question rather than do it separately. Okay. So it's a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning modification of the state income tax system and in connection therewith reducing the state income tax rate from 4.63% to 4.6%, repealing all current state income tax credits, allowing each adult full-day resident taxpayer to claim a state income tax credit of up to an equal share of the sum of all state income tax credits in 2018, plus all state tobacco settlement revenue, all state registration fees over $10 per vehicle, all non-federal revenue to state enterprises started after 2000 without voter approval, and all excess state revenue retained as authorized by state voters in 2005, simplifying state income tax returns and changing procedures for the collection, enforcement, and administration of state income tax.
I would just have one little correction. When you read it, you said full day resident taxpayer, yeah. And it should be full year.
On line 3. So I move that we set title for initiative number 83 as shown on the screen and as read into the record.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All right, the next item on the agenda is 2017-2018, number 73, funding for public schools.
Good afternoon. Edward Ramey, representing the proponents of the initiative. And with me, actually, I'll let them introduce themselves. The representatives of the proponents are here and standing right behind me.
Hi. Donald J. Anderson.
And Martha Olson.
And also with me today is another speaker who has signed up to speak, Tracy Rainey, who is the executive director of the Colorado School Finance Project. She has been working closely with us in the development of number 73 all the way through 79, the measures that we're about to talk about, and has a much deeper understanding than I do of the financial and fiscal aspects. So the extent we get into any of that, if it's okay with the board, we may seek your permission to tag team a little bit so that I don't say something stupid that she has to come up and correct. And
sure, that's fine.
We go down that road. Okay, thank you.
How about we start out, if you want to tell us what you believe the single subject of your measure is?
For number 73, I would say to prioritize the maintenance of a sustainable and equitable system for funding pre-primary through secondary public schools in Colorado.
Any questions from the board? Anyone that you want to bring up besides you on this?
I don't think so. I mean, depending on any questions from the board, I think I'll sort of ringmaster this, but if we get over my head, particularly in the weeds of fiscal issues, I may scream for help. And also, I guess I would like to say, if either of the representatives of the proponents wish to say anything, please just step up here. I don't want to hog the podium.
Yeah, I don't know if there's anyone else signed up to speak, so.
Well, they are, and Ms. Rainey and myself, that's it, I think.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll just start off with my, I guess, biggest concern. And that is, there's a fund set up that is exempt from Tabor, where there will be tax money going into the fund, and that money will be exempt from Tabor.
In this measure?
Oh, not in this one? Oh, okay.
I think so.
Okay. Never mind. We'll get to that one next time then.
Okay.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. Any on this one then? Go ahead.
Sure. I was just saying, just to make sure that I understand the way I'm reading it, it's establishing sort of a adequacy standard for quality of education, and then a standard, an adequacy standard for funding to meet that quality. Is that the way you guys read it?
Yes, that's an apt description. I think I would look at the first paragraph of the measure probably as more an aspirational statement of voter intent, the purpose, what we'd like to accomplish.
Okay.
Then there's a mechanism, particularly in the third paragraph of the measure, for doing that, requiring a level of funding for the schools.
And I guess I read it as maybe more than aspirational, or maybe it still is, because then when you get to subsection 6, it's talking about the report to actually measure. When it says meeting said goals, I assume it's referring to the goals that are stated in print 1.
Right.
Okay. And also where it says in parentheses 3 in the fourth or fifth line down, so that the quality of public education prioritized by this section. Again, that would be the quality of education that you've described in parentheses 1?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I think that's a fair statement. And maybe the word aspirational was a little too light of a word to use. I mean, it is a statement of voter intent. This is what we'd like to see accomplished. But we're not actually doing it other than setting the specific standards set forth further in the measure.
But that is the standard that, if the court were looking at it, that's the standard that the court would judge by. If somebody,
right.
If somebody challenged the quality of education in Colorado, that is the standard that the court would look to.
I would think so. You've just asked a very complicated legal question, however. Courts would certainly look to the intention of the drafters of the measure, and the people who adopt the measure, which would be the voters in this particular case, with all the sort of sources of information that surround that. This is a critical piece of that. Paragraph 1 is absolutely a critical piece of that. Now, if you go into whether meeting a particular phrase within 1 would render something that the legislature had done unconstitutional or not, to me that's a much more complicated and deeper question.
Sure. Okay.
We could go on all afternoon with that.
So subsection 2, at least part of what it does is eliminates the ages of 6.
Right.
You know, that cutoff there. And has no minimum bound. Can you explain how that change is necessarily and properly connected to the funding requirements that are set up in subsection 3?
Sure. Mr. Robert, I think I'd even expand your question. Dropping the phrases between the ages of 6 and, I think it had 21 years of age in there, and also a few lines after that, the 3 months a year requirement that schools be open.
And even earlier, adding the reference to an early childhood.
Right, and we've added that. And basically what we're doing, number 1, is eliminating some anachronistic language in 2 that is, which is contrary to the provisions that we're trying to accomplish in the main body of this measure. The otherwise, there would be a conflict, which I don't think is a conflict in reality anymore. Pre-primary education generally occurs. It's public school activities and funding that goes on. It certainly doesn't start at age six. You're generally at the primary level by then. So leaving that language in conflicts with the new language we're putting in, and in and of itself, it's anachronistic. So all we're trying to do is clean up the measure to facilitate what we state we're trying to accomplish in the other paragraphs of the measure. There's nothing really substantive to the changes being made in number two other than that.
So it's not creating some sort of
no.
early education requirement? I mean,
no.
I guess...
No, I mean, to the extent we're doing that in the other paragraphs, pre-primary is included in that, I think very clearly stated, pre-primary through secondary. We're not affirmatively creating anything in two, except eliminating some very anachronistic language that I guess one could read as discordant with the other paragraphs if we don't clean it up and take it out.
Does I guess one specific question I have is, does that subsection 2 create a right to early childhood education?
No. Well, I think you're pulling it from the language we added at early childhood primary and secondary education.
Right.
No more than is done in the other sections. To the extent it does that, it's what's being addressed in sections 1, 3, and so forth.
I guess the question is, what is early childhood education? I mean, what are you creating an obligation for the state to fund?
I don't think we're defining it in this measure beyond what currently exists.
It's something other than primary, though, right?
Primary would begin with first grade. So this is pre-first grade, which is within the ambit of public education now, in operation, notwithstanding the old language. It's what we address in the balance of the measure. It's part and parcel of what we're talking about in the rest of the measure. We're just bringing paragraph 2 into conformity with what the rest of the measure is addressing. Otherwise, I think, Ms. Steyer, you've hit a point. Otherwise, I think there is a potential conflict, because there would be a guarantee of a certain level in 2 and something different in 1 and 3, and we're trying to solidify it in one term. We have not included a definition of what pre-primary education is.
But just to be clear, you are, with 1 and 2, creating a new constitutional right to be gratuitously educated in early childhood.
Yes.
Before age 6.
Before first grade, yes. Right.
Okay.
And that's there. We're eliminating the contradictory language.
And you don't state when that begins. I mean, that could begin at age 1.
We're not stating that. We've not, on this measure, we have not gone to that level of detail. So that would be left to
the legislative
process.
Okay.
The last sentence of subsection 3 talks about voting, based on a majority of the votes cast.
Right.
It has a reference in that sentence, and I guess I'm not totally sure that this goes to a single subject, but it may. It says, notwithstanding overriding anything to the contrary, in section 1 of Article 5, or section 1 of Article 19.
Right.
Section 1 of Article 19 talks about calling a constitutional convention. It's section 2 of Article 19 that sets up the 55% vote requirement.
Or referred measure. So what you're telling me is I may have the wrong section in there.
Well, I don't know. Are you talking about the constitutional?
What we're talking about.
You tell us.
Well, thank you, Ms. Steyer. No, that was well put. No, it's what we're talking about is not calling not the aspect of calling a constitutional convention, but a vote on a referred measure from the legislature. And I swore, I thought we had the right section number in there from Article 19. If not, the intent was to refer exclusively to referred measures and initiatives, of course.
In my copy of the Constitution,
my copy's getting outnumbered in the room, I think, so.
Here it is.
Okay.
That's part of Section 2 that sets up that higher threshold.
That is intended then to be Section 2. That is a very good catch then. And I'll take your word for it as far as outnumbered copies of the provision. So I guess my question to the board on that question would be, I don't know if you would view that as a change that we could correct here today, or if it's something you need us to go back and get. I'm sure you'll give us a letter on it because the discussion, as a matter of fact, I ought to look at the review and comment memorandum and see.
I think what was cited
in that measure.
I think they refer to, I don't know if, I think they do. So on page 3 of the review and comment memorandum in
72.
1C, for, and this is for measure 73, they do refer specifically to section 2 of Article 19 of the Colorado Constitution. I guess the potential single subject concern that I have would be, one, as I mentioned, whether this is adding a right to early childhood education that was not a pre-existing right. Two, and these are, I guess, potentially three subjects. So there's that one. There's setting the funding, in part 3, the requirement that the assembly ensures that adequate state and local funding be set at this, you know, national average level. And then third, this saying that in the future, the people can change funding through the majority vote, you know, setting aside the, whether you've got the right section in there. And I think I just need a little comfort from you that those things all tie together in a cohesive way that make this not two or three different subjects.
I think they do, Mr. Roper. And let me try to put it like this. The first part of the measure really expresses its purpose of establishing adequate and sustainable and equitable system of funding public education pre-primary through secondary education. That's the purpose of the measure. The funding piece of it is setting a standard for how we'd like to measure that, if you will. We'd like to see it reach the level of personal income, and once you get there, what we're saying is we think you've accomplished the purpose, at least as far as we are concerned. This is the level that by which we would measure your accomplishing the purpose. And all we're saying with reference to the possibility of changing that standard is that if the people or the legislature decide that the standard we're setting, the base level, the measuring level that we're setting is not sufficient in their view, they can change it by a 50% vote. That's it, in my mind, it all ties together. Here's what we're trying to accomplish. Here's how we want to measure whether it's being accomplished or not. And by the way, if you want to monkey with this measurement or this level by which accomplishing this is being measured, you can do this with a 50%.
Just to increase it, right?
Oh, yes, just to increase it. I mean, they could lower it if they wanted to. So I think it all does tie together. The whole purpose is to basically say we're not achieving the standard. We want to achieve the standard. It's important. Here's what the goal looks like. Here's how we want to measure it. Go do it.
So I guess my concern is, could you have voters who would say, yeah, I do think we should have this right to an early childhood education. We think that should be part of the Constitution. But this funding mechanism, I don't really agree with that. And then people on the other, you know, another group of people who may say, yeah, we think the funding needs to be boosted in this way, but whether early childhood is included or not, that's not that important to me. And they would, you know, the log rolling concern that they would join together to enact a measure that might not otherwise survive on its own.
So the concern, if I understand Mr. Roper, is that we're, I think Ms. Steyer may be alluding to this too, that by addressing pre-primary, in addition to primary and secondary, which has always been there, that may be creating in itself a subject independent from everything else we're trying to do. And I guess...
And that's more, if I'm reading it correctly, as setting, creating a right to a gratuitous early childhood education that did not previously exist in the Constitution.
It did. I could not argue that with you. I think it did not exist in so many rules. It's certainly what we do, but it did not exist in the language of the Constitution. So to accomplish what we're trying to do, we were, in our view, eliminating, changing anachronistic language to address the current reality. It wasn't an attempt at log rolling or Christmas treeing or however you
want
to look at it.
Oh, yeah, I'm not trying to impugn
it. No. But, I mean, I can understand the concept, but that certainly was not the intent. I think it would be fair to express the intent as addressing the reality of what we do now in terms of funding public education. It's different from what old paragraph 2 used, you know, said prior to our amendment. So we're trying to address it as it is today. If we didn't make the changes in paragraph 2, then we'd have perhaps a deeper problem in that, I guess an argument could be made that there'd be a conflict between that paragraph and everything else we're trying to do in the same measure, and we'd have litigation over it, potentially internally inconsistent measures.
And what would be the conflict that you're seeing?
That maybe public money shouldn't be used at all for pre-primary education, and we're having public monies used for pre-primary education by the way that the standard that we're developing in 3 and the purposes we're expounding in section 1 are stated. So, I mean, I think in terms of what we're trying to do, it's part and parcel of the same thing, bringing it into current operational reality, not an attempt to create a separate right and entice the voters who may like to see publicly funded primary, pre-primary education but don't care the level at which we do it, and those who would like to see higher funding, I guess, for everything but that. That's we're not trying to go down that rabbit hole, and frankly, I don't know how you do that, and if we did something different, I don't know how you avoid falling into that rabbit hole with the anachronistic language existing as it does. I mean, to be a consistent measure, it seems to me, you have to be talking about the same thing. And if we don't talk about it, then we got an issue that's going to have to be addressed at some point.
I guess I just don't see why it had to be still. Why you couldn't have had this paragraph 3 that has to do with adequate funding that would have still addressed primary and secondary but left out early childhood.
And then have paragraph 2 addressing the existence of a free and uniform system of public schools that does not include that. Does not include pre-primary. And it seems to me that invites exactly the kind of litigation because of a potential inconsistency that we'd not like to see happen. And by the way, if any of the proponents wish to say anything about this, I would invite them with the board's permission to do so. But I mean, that's certainly how I look at it. It's part and parcel of one concept. And if we don't fix the existing provision, we create an internal inconsistency in a single constitutional section that invites further something, litigation or something, merely by virtue of the inconsistency.
Well, aren't you potentially, I mean, inviting litigation on what is early childhood education and what do I have a right to? I mean, can't I claim that my six-month-old needs early education and that this gives me a right to free childcare, essentially?
That's certainly not the intent. And also, you put an age limit on there as well, the start, which we're certainly not, you know.
Well, no, I'm just saying, yeah. Can't I, to take you back to, you know, couldn't I the day after my baby's born say, she's ready for early childhood education now?
Well, you could. The response to that is if we don't do that, the litigation we're inviting is somebody like me coming up saying, wait a minute, there is no right to the right, I guess, is a word I don't want to use. The thorough and uniform system of free public schools in this state does not include pre-primary education. So why are you putting money into something that is not part and parcel of what our system of education includes? You might as well take money under the standard you're specifying in the statute and use it to build bridges or something.
Well, yeah, but isn't that true
now? I think you're called either way you go.
Yeah, but isn't that true now? I mean, you can say, I don't understand why children in Denver get to go to free preschool and children in my district don't. There's no right to it.
We are addressing, I think you're called either way you go with this.
Just because there's no right to it doesn't mean someone can't fund it. It just means they don't have to fund it.
Well, I think we're talking about a statewide funding, which, I mean, the funding would that we're talking about in these measures would have to include pre-primary.
Right.
That's how we're setting it up.
Yeah. And I guess that's what I maybe...
If we don't fix this, but that's without the changes to paragraph 2. Just take paragraph 1 and 3. What we're trying to say in here is the funding needs to incorporate pre-primary education.
Well, and that's my concern, is that paragraphs 1 and 2 are setting up that early childhood pre-primary right that's not a necessary. And I think paragraph 3 doesn't say anything about early childhood or pre-primary education. It just talks about the funding measure. Unless I'm missing...
No, I think you're probably right, but 3 ties into 1, which talks about, definitely includes pre-primary.
Right.
I guess I just think those are the disconnected subjects.
I think you could read it. I'm not as troubled by that. The way I read it is the measure is creating an early childhood to K-12 system that's supposed to meet certain standards. It's supposed to educate children to a certain level. And a funding expectation or requirement designed to meet that level. That's the way I understand this.
I think that's correct. Yes.
So, I was thinking that the single subject is along the lines of adequacy standards for early childhood through secondary school public education.
Right. That's our understanding of it. You put it much better than I have.
You had mentioned, too, that you see the funding level as being, if we meet this funding level, then we've met the standard for 1. Are you saying that if we fund it adequately, then we're producing students that meet this standard?
No.
Okay.
I may have misunderstood. What we're trying to say is, maybe I should use the language of the measure. The General Assembly shall ensure that statewide funding for these purposes referring back to 1, mm-hmm. reaches this particular level, which may be enhanced if the voters of the General Assembly decide to do that. But to ensure that we accomplish what we're trying to accomplish in 1, we define the standard in 3. And again, I guess my, you know, I don't know how to, I certainly understand Ms. Steyer and Mr. Roper's issue, but I don't know practically how to do that other than bringing the old language into conformity with the current world, because if we don't do that, then we have, I think, an internal conflict in that the system of free public schools throughout the state do not, by state constitution, have to include pre-primary, and yet in the next sentence we're saying pre-primary is included in the funding requirements and goals.
And where is that sentence you're referring to where it says pre-primary?
No, I guess what I'm referring generally, that what we're doing in paragraphs 1 and 3 is setting forth a mechanism, in 3 and a level by which to measure accomplishment of the purposes in established in paragraph 1. In other words, paragraph 1 are our purposes, paragraph 3 is how we want to get there and how we'll measure whether we are achieving that or not. Both of those paragraphs include pre-primary through secondary education. If we leave paragraph 2 alone, we've created an internal inconsistency where the entire system of free public education doesn't have to include pre-primary at all, which is completely discordant with 1 and 3. So we tried to fix that, and I certainly take the board's point that by doing that, have we created something more? I don't think so, because what we've said in 1 and 3, which are constitutional measures, are pre-primary is included, and all we're doing in 2 is saying, yeah, pre-primary is included. We're not doing something independent in paragraph 2. And if we don't do that with paragraph 2, we've said pre-primary is included, but no, over here it's really not included, then what we've done doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think I can get there on that one. I do think in light of the Supreme Court cases around the recall initiatives.
You may have to refresh me on those, but what
I mean, essentially, the Supreme Court, I'm looking back at the case, you know, a lot of discussion about changing substantive rights and procedures in the same initiative.
Right.
So
right.
Adding substantive rights, like the right to, you know, this, what you're actually doing in the measure, and then changing the procedural aspects of how to vote for that. I mean, in that case, the Supreme Court said a separate subject was even allowing people to, for instance, circulate 5 people on a single petition than separate petitions. That was an additional subject to changing substantive recall. And so, you know, looking at a case like that where, you know, their language is that a measure allowing for the recall of multiple up to 5 officials on the same recall petition within the same government surreptitious and was a second subject.
Right.
I mean, it just seems that the court has of late been very particular about changing election related or, you know, those kinds of procedures. And so I guess I'd like, and the case I'm looking at is, well,
I think I remember
Hayes. Yeah. Hayes and
right.
Spalding. Hayes. So
I think the distinction here, paragraphs 1 and 3 are really substantive. They're not procedural.
Mm-hmm.
And the change in 2 is substantive as well, to be consistent with 1 and 3, and to prevent that internal conflict. I think it wouldn't make sense if we were mandating a funding level for public schools that included pre-primary. I mean, that's a substantive measure. And then, in the same breath, which is how the measure would read without these changes, say that the state's public school system does not include pre-primary.
Yeah, I'm actually okay with that now.
Okay, so
my question is about changing it from the 55 to the.
Oh, okay. I thought we were.
My
okay.
question is, how is that in any way connected to what you're doing?
Okay.
Substantively, there's nothing that really requires you, the way you've described that. You know, I think I've gotten there on why the rest of it is a single subject, but that one causes me some pause.
Okay.
Not because I think it's that huge of an issue, but I didn't in the recall questions either. And I set we set those questions and we were reversed. So how is this different?
I guess what I would suggest what we're trying to say here. We're setting a standard. The people can change the standard. I guess I would agree, Ms. Dyer, that we are addressing to some extent, the procedure by which the standard could be changed. It strikes me as different from what the Supreme Court was addressing in the recall measures, and it's difficult to compare the two because they're such different topics. I would think the Supreme Court... I come up with a lot of arguments I would make before the Supreme Court. I think that this is not just a procedural change. It's maybe reflective of the, I don't know what how I'd want to put it, but the deference we would accord to a majority vote of the people if they feel that the standard that we would be setting in this measure turns out to be inadequate. That is something a little beyond how many recall candidates you can recall in a single petition or something of that nature, which, by the way, those measures are generally statutory in nature. To my election procedural regulations, and this
right.
would be sort of a constitutional standard where we're setting, but we're saying the people can, by constitutional, can change this if they wish to. It strikes me as different. I'm not articulating it very well, but it strikes me as different from the recall cases. And it's particularly from cases where a change in procedure sort of becomes theoretically an open door to any kind of a change in procedure you might want to make. And we're not really changing anything other than the vote, a constitutionally required vote level for a change in the measurement level that we're setting. We're not nothing else in terms of an initiative or referred measure changes at all. And nothing by doing this suggests that we'd be okay with anything else changing. I don't know if that answers your question. I don't know if I have a good answer to your question. Other than to ask the Supreme Court what they think about it.
I admit I'm not at all familiar with that case. Can you explain sort of what the court's holding was? Because I'm not sure I fully understand it.
Well, I don't have it in front of me, but essentially it was to change recall, and substantively it allowed people to also recall non-elected officers.
Okay.
So that was the substantive change. And then in addition to that, it basically made it easier to recall people. So you could circulate five at a time. You could I think maybe the percentage of signatures wasn't as high. There were a bunch of procedural things in there too, and then the substantive change had to do with who could be recalled.
Do you recall whether the procedural change was making it easier just to recall the new people that it was adding substantively?
No, it was making it easier to recall anybody, and then also there was this sort of strange provision that allowed you to recall a non-elected public official.
Right. Because, I mean, one argument in trying to sort out the substantive versus procedural is it's making a procedural change in terms of the level of majority required, but it's doing it only for these measures which are part of the single subject. And so if that procedural change, I mean, there's an argument that if that procedural change is tied only to these measures that are part of the single subject, then it's still a single subject. I don't know whether the Supreme Court accepts that argument, but there is one.
Well, I think where I am, I think I would probably be inclined to find that this does constitute a single subject. As some the early childhood, as I read the language, I don't think that it, I'm not sure that it creates a right because of the, it uses the word may receive gratuitously an early childhood education. And I think in subsection one, it's more aspirational, should be able to receive, and it doesn't actually create a right there. So I'm comfortable with that. And then as to the, you know, there is maybe a connection of a substantive and procedural aspect here where there's a substantive funding requirement and then a process to increase it, but they are tied together. And it is just as to this particular type of funding. I think it's a close question in my mind, but I'm comfortable that they are all part of a single subject.
I agree. I think that I'm comfortable saying that there's a single subject to it. It's all relating to this idea of the adequacy of public education.
And I'm going to vote no and just rely on ballot title clause 76, which is at 333 Pacific 3rd 76, where I think the court found in opposite to that. So you want to make a motion?
Okay. I'll make a motion that as to initiative 73, we find that it contains a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
And I'm opposed, so that's 2-1. That takes us to the title. And do you have any comments on that, Mr. Ramey?
I do, and I don't know the proponents or Ms. Ramey may as well, but I have.
Can we pause just for a second?
Sure.
Suzanne, just procedurally, when do we address whether it's just a...
We can do that at any point. You want to do it now?
Whenever you want to do it. I just don't know if it makes sense to do after a single subject. Or...
Yeah. Let's just take it up on the issue of whether this simply adds language or is a repeal.
Does not simply repeal.
What is your position on that, Mr. Ramey?
It adds language. I don't think there's any question that this would be a 55% vote.
I'd like
to make that argument.
All right.
I don't think that works.
So, So I'll move under section 140.106.3.5 that proposed initiative number 73 does more than only remove language from the Constitution and would be subject to the 55% threshold.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All right. Now we're on the language. Did you have comments on the language?
Yes, we do. I guess let me start with line 9, the phrase taxpayers' bill of rights. I'd like to, that's almost a reverse catchphrase, unfortunately, due to the popular name of the Tabor Amendment. And I guess I'd like to suggest that we take that out and do something like, use language like permitting the legislature to enact laws without being limited by specified constitutional requirements related to taxation or something of that nature. Or, alternative to that, you could cite Section 20, Article 10 of the state constitution. I like the more general language, but you can use technical language, but taxpayer's bill of rights in a title. Just if I were challenging a measure, I mean, I would say that's a catchphrase. Unfortunately, it's one that bites us.
Well, it's a short title.
Any discussion by the board?
I don't think it's a good idea to put in the constitutional site just because that's non-informative for voters. They don't, some obviously know what Article 10, Section 20 is, but most do not. I will note that the Taxpayer Bill of Rights is the short title in Article 10, Section 20. It says, this provision shall be known as. That said, it's also a lightning rod, so I understand the concern.
I mean, we've had experience with, like, and it, I mean, it is a catchphrase. It's funny, I'm arguing it on the mm-hmm. other side. Proponents usually are arguing that their title contains a catchphrase. But even when titles in the past have quoted directly language in the measure itself, and you're referring to language in a different measure, but language in the measure itself, and that exact language finds its way into the title, those have been held to be catchphrases on occasion, sort of an independent inquiry. So I'd like to get it out of there, if at all possible. I don't want to be put in a position of challenging my own title, which is, but it's just, I mean, it, allowing this to happen encourages all of us then to introduce measures before the title board, which will have, this measure shall be known as the preservation of equal rights in Colorado measure, and that would have to be cited every time we tried to do something to get around it, irrespective of the content. So, again, I would either refer to that phrase, I agree, by the way, that saying Article 10, Section 20 is not informative. That's one way to do it. The other way, the language I liked was just permitting the legislature to enact laws without being limited by specified constitutional requirements related to taxation. Something of that nature kind of tells the voters what we're doing. And those who know what Tabor is know what it is, and they know that's what we're talking about.
I think you could say related to taxation and fiscal year spending, maybe.
Okay.
But are we only talking about Tabor, or are we talking about other things, too?
Well, and then go on to say, or constitutional requirements related to property taxation.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we've never talked about Tabor or Taxpayer Bill of Rights. I mean, usually we talk about voter-approved revenue changes or things like that. I mean, I guess in that way, I prefer Mr. Ramey's language, but
our measure is broader than Tabor. It includes Gallagher.
Yeah.
If you read it.
Yeah. So that's why I don't.
You're right. I think
want to get into Tabor and.
Thank you.
What was your proposed language without being limited by certain constitutional requirements or something like that?
What I said was without being limited by specified constitutional requirements related to taxation. And Ms. Steyer just added, and fiscal year spending, I believe. Or, I'm sorry, Ms. Pellegrin.
I mean, we don't even need to add that. I was just saying that's how we have typically, you know, drafted those kinds of questions. But, you know.
Either is fine. I mean, and really, I mean, it's correct in that Tabor's too narrow, and I think it's a catchphrase. So saying other constitutional provisions, I would agree, is both more accurate and less inflammatory.
Are you proposing we get rid of the language that's highlighted too? That he has shaded right now?
Let me see. That wasn't directed to me.
Okay.
Or was it?
I guess I'm directing it to whomever.
Well, I would think it could come out with the addition of the red line language.
Well, we might not need it at all, depending on what we set the single sentence.
I'd be okay with that. I don't know if we're ready to move on to other things or if you have other comments about the title.
Not about that phrase. I do about the title.
Yeah.
The
single subject. Oh. You want to go back up to the top. Is that right? Or you like the single subject?
I like what you just did.
Okay.
I have no problem with that at all. I have some other comments for language further on in the title.
Okay.
Not single subject addressed, but other. Should I go forward with those?
Sure. Go ahead.
On lines 12 through 14, or what was lines 12 through 14, I think it still is, there's a phrase that reads, requiring that the system of free public schools established by the legislature include early childhood education for residents under 21 years of age, which, by the way, isn't quite accurate, and then semicolon, requiring that the design of the public school system permits every student to receive equal educational opportunity. So let me propose another phrase which I think expresses more exactly what we're trying to do. So we would take that out and it would read, requiring that the system of free public schools established by the legislature provide equitable opportunities for early childhood primary and secondary education through 21 years of age to residents throughout the state. The point being, it's equitable opportunities for residents throughout the state. It's a little shorter, and I think it reflects what we stated in the measure a little more accurately.
If you want the clerk to keep up with you, you'll have to.
I'll do that again. I just wanted to get. I wanted to read it once, and I can read it more slowly.
So I'd kind of be inclined to take out, you know, starting at what is now line 12, the end of line 12 of the requiring, and really just kind of take out the next two or three phrases. I'd probably take out five lines or so.
Well, actually, Mr. Roper, my next comment, this may play into nicely what you're saying, was when we get down to line 14, where it starts declaring that every Colorado resident through 21, I was going to suggest we take out the next four lines, which sounds like it's where you were going. I think there's a lot of stuff in there that can come out. So I would not object to what you were just proposing. Number two, if you wanted to keep going, which may be what you were doing, I think we would keep going with you if the rest of the board is so inclined.
when I read it, I was going to move the line 16 that starts declaring, I was going to move that phrase to be first after in connection therewith.
Well, let me read that phrase. I might want to agree with you. I don't think we would object to that either, frankly. if you wanted to take that last phrase and move it up.
I think, and I might change it a bit, but I would move it. Instead of secondary education that meets stated goals, I would say that adequately prepares students to meet stated goals. Because I realize that you feel like that's aspirational, but I think that's setting the new standard for public education.
We would have no objection to that change.
Well, if we keep that language, and I think I'd be inclined to take it out, but this feels like it's getting really long, but I think keeping that, I think we would need to say instead of should receive an early childhood, I think it should say follow the language of the measure and say should be able to receive. Which is a slightly different meaning, I think, but.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I don't know that I'd keep any of that language.
Oh, I agree. But definitely.
Because you think it's surplusage, or?
Yeah, and aspirational, and just trying to find some ways to cut down the. I don't know what, if anything, that does. That language does.
And I'm just aware that in other states, Colorado has never had a standard in the Constitution for what public education should achieve. We just say you have to have a system. In other states where their Constitution does set a standard for what education should achieve, and it states it in usually language similar to this, that's very aspirational, the courts say that's the standard, and they have held funding to be unconstitutional because it wasn't enough to meet that kind of a standard. So that's why I feel like it's more hardcore than aspirational, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I'd favor taking it out, but.
I'm fine if you want to reduce it and reduce some of the other aspirational language that's in there, but I do think we need to somehow be clear that it is setting a new standard for education, a new constitutional standard for education. I don't know, maybe that's too much of a legal interpretation to put in a title, and if that's true, then I will go with, I mean, if that's how you guys feel, I'll certainly go with that, but.
Could we take out the, and maybe, hopefully this wouldn't undermine the point, but take out the on line four, the language that adequately prepares students to meet stated goals. Maybe just highlight that, Stephen, but don't delete it.
Like I said, I do kind of feel like that's the point.
Okay.
But we could take out through age 21, because that's already in the Constitution through age 21. That's not a change. And being able to receive early childhood, primary, and secondary education just makes it clear what level of education you're talking about. And most kids get that way before 21. And so I don't know that the should be able, or the age 21 part adds anything.
How about taking out to meet stated goals? Maybe that doesn't help you there.
Wow.
And the stated goals are knowledge, or is it preservation of liberty in a free and democratic society, as well as the ability of every person to develop his or her full potential and participate meaningfully in the civic and economic life of the community?
Yeah, let's put that in there.
I think it's those last two things are the stated goals.
Sure.
I'm thinking, not to interrupt the board's thinking process here, but it's pointed out to me that we get down to line in the 16-17 and on, this language has got to come out because I think we've moved things up above which are addressing mm-hmm. those points. So I don't want to forget that when we get back down to line 16,
okay.
Grinding through
right.
what we're discussing now.
Having said that, declaring that they're receiving an early childhood primary and secondary education, we can take out requiring that the system includes early childhood education?
Yes.
That's lower down.
Right. And that's that language, and it's going off the screen right now, but yeah. I think there's probably a bunch of language down there that we want to take out.
So, yeah, starting if – can we scroll down a little bit? Yeah, so there where it says requiring, I think we could, on line 16 where it starts requiring, I would be okay with taking that out.
Right.
Up one. Whoops.
I'd be okay with taking that phrase out.
I agree.
And we might be able to take the next one out as well, having right. said what we said about be available on thorough, uniform, consistent, equitable basis.
We would agree with that.
I'm okay with that language in 2 through 5.
Well, I guess I would like to just see it a little less catchphrasy because, I mean, the stated goals are to be able to participate, to reach your full potential and participate meaningfully in the, I mean, these stated goals are clearly pretty aspirational. And then you have that it shall be made available on a thorough. Well, if it's doing these stated goals, then isn't that thorough? And isn't uniform the same as equitable? I mean, can we just not put in
I think
I mean, can we pare it down so that it's not an ad for
yes, thinking back to bilingual education initiative in 1820 or whatever that measure was up here, where a phrase as rapidly and effectively as possible turned out to be a catchphrase lifted from the measure. Yes, I would agree, Madam Chair, that if that phrase should come out. If any word, I mean, consistent and equitable maybe would be left in, but I don't think we would object in terms of the title to that entire phrase coming out.
I mean, does it say anything to say it's going to adequately prepare them to meet stated goals?
No. I'm agreeing with you.
Okay.
No,
can we just say thorough? I mean, that's the same thing. The stated goals are, well.
The only reason I would say it's not is because thorough and uniform has always been there, and it's always only been applied to basically do you have education throughout the state. this is now saying this has to be education that adequately prepares students to some level.
Well, then I think if we're going to say to meet stated goals, then we should put the whole goal in there. Because I think the goal is a total catchphrase. So let's just go and put an ad in for people to vote for measure.
I'm actually on Madam Chair's side on this issue. I mean, one thing we've run into in the past is you can have language in the measure itself, which has meaning within the measure in itself, but if it has blinking lights attached to it, and it ends up in the title goes down. And I don't obviously do not want to take a risk of that. An example I gave a moment ago is an example of precisely that kind of thing. So I'm not even sure everybody in the room that I'm working with here would agree with me, but I would not object to, I mean, the phrase thorough, uniform, consistent, and equitable runs the risk, I think, of exactly what Ms. Steyer says. And I would rather not invite that. I would rather have, even though thorough and uniform has been around forever, equitable basis actually has a substantive meaning to it that is important to this measure. So I think that could probably be retained. And it really means something. It's not a catchphrase. It's a descriptive term that's core to this measure. But when you start loading the other terms, as good as they are, I think we walk into exactly the trap that Madam Chair is describing.
Can we go ahead then and take out to meet stated goals and just say adequately prepare students?
Because I would probably, could we take that all out? Just leave it at secondary education. Declaring that every Colorado resident should be able to receive an early childhood, primary and secondary education, and that educational opportunity should be available on an equitable basis throughout the state.
I think that doesn't give notice that there's a standard. If you said at least adequately prepare, that it gives some notice that there's a standard. And maybe, I mean, maybe I'm reading it wrong and there's not really a standard. Maybe it won't be interpreted that way.
Yes. That's what there's.
I mean, my concern is that the average voter sees the word standard and they think about a standardized test, or they think about I'm able to read at a certain level at fifth grade, or I can do math at this level at seventh grade. And that is not anything like what this standard looks like. So that's kind of my concern with saying stated standards, is that if I'm the average voter looking at this question, which is why I don't mind the word equitable, because I think what we're trying to say there is equitable throughout the state, and I think that means something to people when they vote. They want to see, or maybe they don't want to see, whatever, but, you know, this issue of whether education is equitable when we talk about, like, the Front Range in rural Colorado is certainly something that voters read a lot about, know a lot about. So I'm trying to think about, you know, and I understand that other terms such as thorough and all the, you know, have been legal standards, but the voters don't care about the legal standards. And in fact, it can confuse them if we're using them in a way that isn't meaningful to their lives. So to say you're going to meet stated goals, if I didn't have this in front of me, and most voters don't when they vote on a question, they read the question, maybe the blue book, I mean, what does that mean, stated goal? I would think something measurable. And this, I don't think, is very measurable.
I would agree, Madam Chair, in that the standards that we do set are funding standards, not achievement standards. So and I hadn't really thought that phrase could be misleading in that regard, but it could. I think you're right.
I mean, if you're talking about funding standards, then we should just say funding standards.
I'm okay with taking out to meet stated goals.
My worry, though, is that leaving in adequately prepared students makes it sound like, you know, adequately prepares them for college or for the workplace or something, as opposed, and that's not what the measure is declaring. Oops. I mean, it's talking about meaningful participation and developing their potential. I think I would take that phrase out, that adequately prepares students.
Do you want to just offer that? Ms. Rainey is whispering something in my ear, but she's been offered the opportunity to speak, so I just let her offer.
Oh, it's okay with the word.
What about having education adequately and equitably? Sorry, that angle's bad. Adequate and equitable opportunities should be available on a statewide basis.
I'm fine with that.
You mean taking out all the Colorado resident early childhood, primary, and secondary education?
No, I think she's just saying that after we say that is adequate, what was it? That is maybe. That is adequate and equitable on a statewide basis. Is that what you said? Throughout the state?
No. That light is really bad.
Like that? Taking out that?
No. Opportunities.
Yeah. Opportunities.
Adequate and equitable.
Adequate and equitable opportunities
throughout the state.
But you can't say it's an education that is adequate and equitable opportunities.
Yes, that's true. Providing opportunities.
That provides adequate and equitable opportunities.
Yeah,
no, the education isn't providing equitable opportunities. They have an equitable opportunity to education.
Yes.
Well, after education, why we say that is provided at, how about, should be able to receive an adequate early childhood, primary, and secondary education, and
and that educational opportunities.
Is it the I'm trying to go back to now what's equitable. Is it the opportunity? Is it the education? What's equitable?
Okay. It's the opportunity. It's that's for us.
The opportunity.
Right. And receive. No, I think we're really going off the measure now.
Maybe declaring that every Colorado resident should have an opportunity to receive an early childhood, primary, and secondary education on an equitable basis throughout the state, something like that.
Fine with that.
Sure. On an equitable basis.
But you're right, opportunity is the key.
And take out that is adequate.
And on an equitable basis. Right.
What if we take out the next requiring clause and go straight to requiring that statewide funding is maintained? And I would put it in the active voice, requiring the legislature to maintain statewide funding. And I think at least isn't accurate. I think you're require. I think the measure requires the legislature retain or to maintain funding at an amount equal to a percentage of the total personal income that's at least equivalent to the national percentage.
Yes, that's correct.
Is there any way to cut that down?
I try.
That's kind of confusing to read through.
It's really confusing.
Could we just say something like equal to the national average percentage?
Does it lose meaning if we say to maintain statewide funding for school districts at a percentage of the total personal income that is at least equivalent to the national average?
Yeah, I think that's what.
Yeah.
He's proposing.
Is that what you're saying?
That wasn't exactly it, but that helps.
No, not there. Up above, two lines up, where it says at an amount that is equal to a percentage of the total personal, take out an amount that is equal to. No, keep at. Mm-hmm. We'll make it as unreadable as possible. And I think it's the national average of percentages of statewide personal income. It's an average of those percentages, right? Well, maybe not. Hang on.
Statewide funding for school districts.
I know that matters.
Dedicated not to public schools.
I'd say dedicated to public schools in other states, though.
What did we say in the measure?
Finding legislatures maintain statewide funding for school districts.
Public education.
Yeah.
We just had. Ms. Rainey just pointed out at one point that dedicated, what line are we on here? Dedicated to public schools, that tracking the measure should be dedicated to public education.
Okay.
Public schools would just be changed to public education, right?
Does it make it any more clear if we said that is at least equivalent to the average percentage of statewide personal income dedicated to public education in other states? Is it the national that makes it hard to follow, or does the national make it better? Or does it not matter?
I can't see a way to improve upon what's there.
They wouldn't have to say compared to.
No, I don't think so. That's what that is.
The national average of statewide personal income.
They were talking about that.
Are we ready to move to the next phrase? I think we can clarify that one a little bit to say increase by a majority a simple majority rather than a 55% majority vote of the people?
Wait a second, I think Hattie had a different idea on that one.
Yeah, simple majority, comma, rather than 55%, comma, majority, or majority, comma, vote. Permitting the voters to approve an increase in the required funding. Yeah, start at the top. Permitting the voters to approve an increase in the required funding by a simple majority rather than a 55% majority vote, semicolon.
You could even take out the rather than 55 unless the board feels that keeping that is informative in the context of what we're doing.
I think it's important just because it highlights to people why we're even saying it.
We can certainly see that point.
And you can take of the people out after vote on line 11.
Oops. Uh-oh.
Not sure what's going on.
We're going to search for something.
Technical malfunction, Dick.
There we go. So, yeah, take out.
I like phantom keys.
All right. Take out of the people in line 11.
Do you even need vote then?
Maybe not. On line 13, I don't think we need is, and just say as necessary to ensure. And I think we can combine the one about permitting the legislature and permitting the school districts by saying permitting the legislature to enact and school districts to implement laws without being limited.
And what kind of laws are we talking about?
This is the raising taxes and.
Well, we're talking Tabor and Gallagher, right? Mm-hmm. So, what can they do under this, Mr. Ramey, that they can't do now?
Excuse me.
What can they do without these limitations? I mean, what are some examples of what they could do that they can't do now?
Anything that they come up with. In other words, measures would be, they could, legislature could implement funding mechanisms not consistent with the Tabor revenue and spending requirements. They could mandate a different Gallagher structure. If they wanted to, than the one that's posed by that amendment. Things I probably can't even imagine. But whatever the restrictions are that are put on by Tabor and Gallagher, they would not have to comply with. We're trying to be as broad as possible and leave it to the discretion of the legislature and initiative proponents, if necessary.
I would imagine that would then have a spillover effect potentially into how they do the rest of the budget, or because they could take this and make a separate fund out of it, and it would be.
That's not the goal, and we puzzled about that. We sort of, here we get into the question of speculating about possible strategies in the future as to how this might be implemented, and it's hard to do that here. I don't even think we're supposed to be doing that. But it's not our intent to create any devious mechanism. I would say that as part of the legislative intent, other than precisely what we're saying. I'm sure something's going to happen, but I couldn't even begin to speculate right at this point what somebody's going to come up with.
I think it's more just how much do we want to highlight this section? We need to be careful not to bury it if it's.
Right. So the phrase you're particularly concerned with is permitting the legislature to enact and school districts to implement laws without being limited by specified constitutional requirements related to taxation as necessary to ensure that adequate state and local resources are available to fund public schools.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm okay with that. And there's always a prospect for mischief, but it's very limited here in terms of the goal to which it could be used. And
I'm fine with it the way it is now. I think that that will probably be further explored if there's a protest, and you know, then there'll be some debate and.
Even then, I mean,
maybe
I
would, some different language offered.
It's hard to discuss that out of context. And at least my experience with the Supreme Court is they try to read measures in post-adoption context in a rational, logical manner, assuming the voters knew the law at the time, not creating, they use the word absurd all the time. And I hate to be on the other end of it when I'm making arguments like that. But they frequently use that language. We're not going to entertain a use of this language, it produces an absurd result. And I guess I'd rely on that. I think the court would continue in that tradition.
So on line 9, do we need to say funding laws or implement funding laws or put something there?
It might be broader than just technically a funding law. It could be something around taxation. It could be something around an assessment rate. I mean, I think it comes down on line 10 and 11 to be tied back to funding.
Okay.
Could we put a comma after enact and after implement, just so it makes it a little easier to read? Line 9, I'm sorry. On the last phrase, I think we can shorten it some by saying requiring the legislature to publicly report every 5 years concerning the concerning achievement of the stated goals. I would say of the goals stated in the amendment, actually. So what I shortened, I added. Do we need a publicly report, or do we even need that? Who else would we report to? The legislature. That's fine.
I think it's fine.
Oh, I'd make a pitch that I don't think our single subject is funding related to early childhood through secondary school public education. I think it's adequacy of early childhood through secondary and school public education. Because setting the bar for what the education system is to accomplish is not necessarily funding. But funding, the funding part is related to setting that aspirational bar.
How about just concerning early childhood through secondary school public education?
Since there can't be any amendments added, that'll be fine. In the legislature, no.
So the language that we typically have used when we talk about requirements related to taxation is revenue and spending limitations, which then, in our view, has triggered people to think about things like Tabor and Gallagher. I'm just wondering if this is a little bit broad, constitutional requirements related to taxation. I mean, we've had that language about revenue and spending limitations go up a number of times in front of the court. And
of course,
I'm just wondering if maybe we should reword that a little bit on line 10.
Problem here is that Gallagher refers to assessment rates,
right,
which is the issue there that the legislature may want to address. Whereas Tabor, it's revenue and spending limitations. You're absolutely right. But that wouldn't incorporate Gallagher. So I'm...
Well, maybe we should say... Right. I mean, we're talking property assessments, right?
Right.
Property assessments.
But then again...
Limitations on property assessments, revenue and spending? I don't know.
Or revenue and spending and property taxation.
Could. I was liking how short it was getting, but I can see the point. Probably should be revenue and spending limitations.
Yeah, and property, but it's being limited by,
right,
that. There's got to be a better way to do that.
It's not just
and property assessment, maybe.
Yeah.
Kind of wherever we go, we start going down.
But I was going to say, it refers to all of PRIN 3, right, which is more than just Gallagher. Subsection 1 of Section 3, but even that.
It's all Gallagher. Yeah.
No, it's B.
Yeah, we've just added a subparagraph to the existing Gallagher.
I think we could get rid of specified and just say limited by constitutional requirements related to revenue. I mean... Being, is there some way to get rid of being limited by?
Regardless of, or notwithstanding, or as an exception to?
Without regard to?
Yes. Assessment rates. A lot of challenge goes as misleading.
How about I read it, and then we can see if there's anything else we want to do. It's an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning early childhood through secondary school public education, and in connection therewith, declaring that every Colorado resident should have an opportunity to receive an adequate early childhood, primary, and secondary education on an equitable basis throughout the state, requiring the legislature to maintain statewide funding for school districts at a percentage of the total personal income of Colorado residents that is at least equal to the national average percentage of statewide personal income dedicated to public education, permitting voters to approve an increase in the required funding for school districts by a simple majority rather than 55% majority, permitting the legislature to enact and school districts to implement laws without regard to constitutional requirements related to revenue and spending limitations and property taxation as necessary to ensure that adequate state and local resources are available to fund public schools, and requiring the legislature to report every 5 years concerning the goals stated in the amendment.
So, Madam Chair, the only thing I may have misheard, but in line 6, I think the phrase "at least equivalent" you read at last read "at least equal to" when you were reading it.
Equivalent to.
At least equivalent
to. I would propose that we get rid of that 55% and simple majority, because permitting voters to approve an increase in the required funding for school districts I mean, that's typically going to happen at a local level, not at a, not at the state level.
Maybe we want to say constitutionally required funding, because that's...
Yeah, I mean, otherwise, that's very confusing to someone like me who's just used to voting for my school district, not thinking the state has a big role. Anything else?
Nope.
All right. You want to make a motion? No, I just said we should take the whole thing out, but they wanted to add a word.
All right. I move that we set the title for proposed initiative number 73 as shown on the screen.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
All right, so that takes us to number 74. And Mr. Ramey, you want to kick us off?
Sure. Purpose of 74, to establish a sustainable and equitable mechanism to fund pre-primary through secondary public education in Colorado.
Anyone have any questions for that?
Just to make sure I'm reading it clearly. I have to find it. Sorry, I didn't have it marked. I don't have a page number, sorry. In section 3 of the measure, statutory section 2255109, parentheses 4. Clarifying that by saying that the monies from the Quality Public Education Fund shall be appropriated and expended to support public schools, that would mean that it cannot be used for any kind of a private school voucher program unless it was related to a student with a disability?
That is the intent, with the exception of the exception stated there.
Right. Okay.
So in this one, you create the fund, and the new taxes go in the fund, right?
Yes.
And then any other money they put in the general, they put in the fund, goes in the fund?
Having heard the discussion this morning, I mean, the intent of this is that other monies from other sources may from time to time, if somebody so is so disposed, be dedicated to the fund. This isn't a closed fund where our tax goes into this fund and that's it. But we're not dedicating any other money to the fund other than the money that we're getting through the tax increment set forth in this
measure.
But if
the General Assembly puts money in that fund, the money they put in there is exempt from Tabor.
Unless they have a way to do that independent of that's not the intent. Let me just put it this way. The money in the fund has to be, I guess I'm not sure. Let me make sure I'm clear of the question you're asking. The fund is not being designed or intended to be some kind of a receptacle for money that would otherwise be subject to revenue and spending limitations, and we just dump it in this fund and all of a sudden it's not. The thought would be to get the money dedicated into the fund. It would either have to come from a source that's not subject to those limitations, or the dedication would have to include a measure like that. We're not trying to do a whole wholesale de-Brucing of
Colorado. I mean, that's economy. My concern is that, you know, the legislature is a billion over 1 year on their
right.
Tabor cap, and so they decide we don't want to go to the voters, so we're going to put right. it in this fund, and then is the way this is written, that money is now not subject to the cap because they've moved it into the fund.
Right.
Or, you know, they can take anything that they currently dedicate to education, put it in the fund, and then not count it in the cap, and all of a sudden they have money for transportation and everything else.
That is not the intent of the measure, and of course it would also be a consequence of the legislature trying to do that, because then they'd have the money they put in there restricted to the purposes of the fund. They couldn't get it out, so I'm not sure that is a would be a smart move on their part, but take that as a possibility. That is not the intent of the measure. And again, I think we're in one of those areas where in a post-adoption context and somebody tried to do something, what I would say is almost perverse of that nature, would the courts uphold it on the language of this particular measure? I don't think they would. The standard is usually that if somebody's trying to do something and we're measuring it against a constitutional standard, is it logical? Is it constitutionally palatable? Is it consistent with the intent of the measure when it was adopted by the voters? And nothing like you're describing is implied here, and frankly, we're stating it's not consistent with our intent. To attempt to say all that, I would suggest really isn't necessary. All we're trying to say is if there is another source of money that somebody wants to dedicate to the fund, they can so dedicate it. But there are parameters to that dedication that I think are logically consistent with all of the applicable constitutional measures, including this one. And unless we specifically suggest otherwise, it shouldn't be presumed that we're negating other measures. And in fact, in this particular measure, as an example, the money that we are putting in, we in fact specifically de-Bruce in a separate statutory provision. I mean, I suppose in the single measure we could have just put it in, but we say that the money in the measure is de-Bruced, and then when we take our tax increment revenue in the last section of this measure, we actually so dedicate it. So that's what we would expect other people to have to go through the same hoop. I would say, the other problem with that, if you either end up putting all this language in, trying to bar the prospect of something that is inconsistent with our own intent, or we are silent on that piece, which could also be argued then that this is virtually a closed fund. It's this fund relates to this tax increment, period, and nothing else. We have to argue about that in the future. We certainly don't want to do that. So that's, I think the language works, and it's certainly not intended to create some perverse and abusive mechanism a perverse mechanism that I don't think would work anyway, because once the money lands in the fund, it's going to public education.
Yeah, constitutionally. My concern is the all money is deposited, so it's not just the money that is collected from the income tax increment. I mean, if you had just said the income tax increment shall be deposited in this fund, and then that fund is not subject to, you know, Tabor limits, that'd be one thing. But then, you know, the General Assembly could put money in that fund too, and then you say all money's deposited.
I would suspect, well, first off, I don't want to predict too much, because I think we're in the post-adoption world right now. What if somebody tries to do something like this? How would the court look at it? Not our intention to facilitate that.
I think this one is actually, I mean, compared to what we had in front of us this morning, which was maybe it means that, or maybe I think this one's pretty clear. That's what it means. all money deposited.
But it needs to get into the fund, it needs to be dedicated to the fund. And what I'm suggesting is a fair reading of this measure, and I think the one that a court would adopt in a post-adoption context is you can't just dedicate money into this fund without addressing limitations that may be upon that money through other constitutional provisions. Wholesale, you can't ignore those. That's certainly our intent. And I hadn't really thought it through until I heard the same discussion this morning that you had in a somewhat different context. But that is not what we're trying to do. But we're also not trying to say that we're it. This is the only source of revenue that ever goes into this fund. But this isn't a mechanism. Again, and here's where it's difficult at a title board level, because we're predicting would the Supreme Court, I think, view a transfer of funds that are otherwise subject to revenue and spending limitations into this fund by the legislature or by somebody else to get around those limitations. Would they view that as a thing that you could do? My prediction of what the court would do in the face of this measure is they absolutely would not view it that way. But I know the Attorney General's office would probably not view it that way. But we also don't want to say we're it, because other sources of revenue dedicated, which I would read as legally and properly dedicated to this fund, can go into the fund if somebody decides to do that. And it may not just be revenues. It could come from some other source, a fee. I have no idea what a fee that could go into this fund would conceivably look like, but somebody may think of such a possibility. We're happy to see the fund grow. But then
the fee isn't subject to
The
table cap either.
What we're saying is if there's another source of money that somebody can appropriately, through dedication, get into this fund, that's great with us. We'd love to see the fund grow, but this is not meant to be an evasive mechanism.
That's a total change, too, because right now fees do count against the base.
Right.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So
you could have a fee, and then you could put that fee into the dedicated fund and get around the Tabor base.
Well, then, to the extent you're trying to get around another measure, see, I mean, the point I'm, I guess, not eloquently enough making is this is not intended to be an evasive mechanism. But it also is intended to suggest the fund remains open for other appropriately dedicated sources of revenue or something other than revenue. But it has to be appropriately dedicated. We're not speaking to the dedication of the funds. Once it gets appropriately in here, then this provision says we can disregard those particularly spending limitations going forward. And to evidence that, we've done that in this measure. Having the last section of the measure where we do precisely that is not just superfluous. I mean, what we're trying to say is we are hereby dedicating these tax increment funds or these tax increment revenues to this fund. So if you want to do it in the future, do it like this. Now, we haven't said that, but I think a court would enforce it in that fashion, because I think our intent is evidenced. If I'm not making it clear enough here, I think our intent is very clearly evidenced. This is not an evasive mechanism by any means, but we're happy to see the fund grow.
Can I back up kind of big picture here?
Sure.
First, just as a procedural thing, does this have the same proponents as the last measure?
Yes.
And they're still here.
They're both sitting here. Yep.
I also just want to, we never really dealt, going back to 73, we never really dealt with that Section 1, Section 2 issue as to Article 19. Whether it was referring to the right.
I'm glad you brought us back.
And I don't want to.
Sorry, what was the issue?
Is that 55%?
The 55%.
The convention.
In other words, I cited the wrong section?
Yeah, sorry.
I'm
jumping back to the prior initiative, number 73. Yeah,
it's all constitutional.
No.
On number 73, the board ruled that this does not only repeal.
Yeah, but he's talking about the miscite.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I missed section one instead of section two.
Okay, so the board wanted to make a technical correction? Is that right, what I'm hearing?
I would request that. But that did get lost in the discussion here, correct?
Is that the type of technical corrections that the board has made in the past?
No. I mean. I mean, I don't know that you really need to make it. I mean, this. I mean, the fact that that it's miscited, it's still going to be a change that came after that change, and it will supersede the language regardless of whether you cited the correct section.
That's true.
I mean, you say in there that notwithstanding this provision, it'll take a 50% vote. I mean, the effect is going to be given to the fact that it's a 50% vote, regardless of whatever else exists in the Constitution.
Right.
Currently, because it will be passed subsequent to that.
I would agree. I mean, I guess I would submit it's either a technical amendment because of a typographical error that I made with the section. And if it goes forward like this and is not corrected, I have absolutely no doubt that any court looking at this would construe it appropriately, because it makes no sense addressed to the section cited. It makes complete sense addressed to the one we're intending. So I leave it to the board.
I guess, I mean, my thought would be I'd just flag that for you, and you need to decide what, if anything, you do about it.
That's fair.
So sorry to jump us out to 73. Coming back to 74, I just want to You have changes both to the Constitution and statutory changes.
Yes.
And I know legislative counsel flagged that as well. Is that something that you can do in a single initiative?
I think you can, as long as you stay consistent with a single subject. Now, on the voting requirement, there's no question that we're affirmatively amending the Constitution, so this whole measure goes to the 55% level. I think, I'd be happy to find out otherwise, but I think that's a consequence of this. But I've never, to my knowledge, heard it suggested that you can't, consistent with a single subject, include both constitutional and statutory provisions together in one measure.
But that was before there were different voting requirements for constitutional and statutory measures.
I don't think Amendment 71 changed that. What it says is if we're amending the Constitution, we have to go to a 55% vote. Now, if I were submitting to you all that we get a different vote for the statutory versus constitutional provisions, I think there would be a discussion here. We're not saying that. This is a 55% measure, because in this measure we are, in fact, amending the Constitution.
Is it a problem that in Article 5, Section 1, Print 4, Print A, it says when the measures are referred to the ballot and they go to an election, all such measures shall become the law or a part of the Constitution when approved by a majority of the votes cast thereon, or, if applicable, the number of votes specified in 4B? One reading of that would be to say, if you got 52% of the vote on this, does the statute have to become law? It says it's a measure, shall become law. It got 50% of the vote.
I would argue in a court on this question that the answer to that's no, that this is a measure that includes a constitutional amendment, and we got to hit 55 with this. That's my, now, by the way, that's my off-the-cuff interpretation of a brand-new constitutional amendment, so that the Supreme Court has never addressed, to my knowledge. And if we got 52% of the vote, I might be asked to raise that. But that's different from single – that's not a single-subject inquiry. That's a vote-level inquiry. Which is, again, one reason why I think if we're going to offer you a measure that has both statutory – well, I mean, for example, with a little research, I'm sure I could come up in the past with constitutional measures that also included implementation legislation along with the measure. But we didn't have the issue of the 55 or 50% vote. So the question you posed, Ms. Pellegrin, I think is almost more of a question, not how to interpret our measure, but how to interpret Amendment 71. It would be addressed to that. I mean, we got this measure passed. 52% of the voters approved this measure. So what does that mean? There's nothing in our measure that answers that question. Amendment 71 answers that question. And I've given you my off-the-cuff and really kind of against my own interests thought about that. But
I don't think it has anything to do with title setting. I mean, whether something passes down the road is
an
issue for everyone to litigate down the road.
I agree.
I don't believe any of those divested us of jurisdiction or an ability to even take that up in our deliberations. I mean, if it creates two subjects, then that's one thing, but we are very limited in our application of that particular amendment to only determine whether it's an addition or a repeal. And we've already determined by your admission that it's a, well, not on this one, but I guess we'll get to that, that these are additions to the Constitution.
Yes.
But in your view, the fact that we're amending the Constitution, or that the initiative would amend the Constitution and add laws, would not make it more than one subject?
No. I would say that in two ways. I mean, everything in this measure addresses the same subject. It's not a single subject question. What's prompting the single subject question here, and I would also suggest, I mean, this has been done in the past, not all that infrequently, where you have constitutional statutory provisions together. What's prompting the question now is a different voting requirement for constitutional measures. And again, I'd go back to the point, if whatever effect that has, they didn't say anything in Amendment 71 about changing the concept of single subject. So single subject is single subject. And as Madam Chair just said, I think, you know, I can imagine someday we're going to have to address what Amendment 71 means if you've got a combined measure like this or an integrated measure like this. And I may be arguing the other side of that issue at that time, so don't hold me to what I said today.
Okay.
And I guess, I mean, Ms. Rainey just actually mentioned something else to me, too. We don't want this statute to go into place without, in terms of single subject analysis, this is one integrated package for us. We want all of this together. And we've got a constitutional creation of a fund, but we also have a affirmative constitutional amendment to allow us to do the tax increments. We can't do the tax increments unless
we're... Sure, but it's not really up to you.
Excuse me?
It's not really up to you.
I mean, no.
These things take on a life of their own, and it's not like you can just...
No, but let me refer back to... I hate to refer back to this as a precedent, but let me go back to Amendment 66, for example. They did a tax increment. Mm-hmm. They couldn't do it without amending the Constitution, so they amended the Constitution in the same measure in order to do it. So pre-71. So I think that has been the understanding and tradition in the single subject analysis to date. And I don't think 71 changed that. And Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. It isn't my call. But that's a post-adoption, post-vote issue, not ours.
Yeah, I don't have problems with it from that perspective. I mean, commonly things are written that the legislature shall then implement. You just chose to implement yourself, basically. I still have a problem with this Section D of all monies deposited. I haven't gotten past that one, but.
I don't know if there's anything more I could say to help on that, but again, that's not our intent. And the concept of, I guess I would say with D, monies have to be dedicated to get into the fund. As a matter of fact, the phrase in paragraph B on the fourth line, after we refer to the income tax increment revenues to be approved in this measure, and through any other tax or source of funding dedicated by the people or the General Assembly to this fund, I would suggest that reasonable post-adoption interpretation of that is dedication requires compliance with applicable law to those revenues, unless we've somehow indicated in here something different, and it is not our intent to do that. And again, I say we've given an example of that. That's why we did it. We complied in the last section of this measure in our dedication in terms of debrucing to get the money into this revenue. That's our concept. That's our intent. And I frankly, I mean, in all seriousness, I cannot imagine the Supreme Court in a post-adoption context viewing it any differently. It flies against all of their guidelines of adopting a logical analysis consistent with constitutional requirements, presuming that the existing law is understood at the time of adoption, not creating absurd results. And, I mean, the result, Madam Chair, that you stated borders on what I would suggest might be an absurd result if the legislature did something like that. I don't think they'd do it, and if they did it, I don't think the Supreme Court would tolerate it. Most important, that's not our intent here.
Can you explain how the change to Article 10, Section 20, 8A is consistent with a single subject where you add this exemption, you know, to the single rate issue for funding schools, public schools, basically.
Pre-primary through secondary public
schools.
Yeah,
and then specifically if you could address how, because the concern is you may have people who think, no, that would be a good thing to do to allow incremental rates, but may not agree with setting up the other fund or some of the other measures.
All this amendment does is permit us to establish tax increments for the purpose of funding pre-primary through secondary education. That's all it does. It doesn't open the door to graduated taxes or anything else of that nature. So this language actually was largely tracked from the Amendment 66 language that was approved. And I'm not sure if it was challenged. I actually don't think so at the Supreme Court level, but it was approved by the title board as necessary. You had to make the necessary constitutional amendment in order to do the statutory fund. And this one is tailored to what we're doing. So it's one subject. I mean, we could state it more broadly or more narrowly, but it's the same subject. It's constitutionally facilitating what we're trying to enact statutorily in this measure. So, I mean, if anything, it's a single subject because we can't do it without that change. And the change is tailored to letting us do this.
Thank you. So I don't have anything more on single subject.
Okay. I'm thinking more about the sources to the fund. I mean, I understand, it's just I'm thinking that there's certainly a lot of ways you could get a lot of money into that fund to overcome TABOR restrictions without it being a clear violation of a TABOR restriction. I mean, you were saying you can't, you have to do it legitimately and not in violation of the law. I think there's a lot of ways you could do that. So I think I'm inclined to agree with Susan on the whether that piece, because it isn't limited. I understand what your intent is, and you didn't intend for any nefarious action to go on around that, nefarious, quote unquote. But the language is there. And it's not ambiguous. So I'm not sure the court would ever get to what was your intent.
I might debate that, but, and I guess the only reason I would debate it is that the result, I think, Ms. Pellegrin, that you're positing is what I would call not a reasonable or not absurd result. And I think the courts are consistently clear that because they're always interpreting measures, that they're not going to choose a result among options that they have that creates something that doesn't make sense. That is, as they always use the word absurd. I hate to keep repeating it, but that's the word that they generally use. And I would suggest if this measure, one suggested this measure is susceptible to being read to accomplish what you just said, that would be such a result, and the courts would never see it that way, and particularly after the record we've made here today. But I just cannot imagine they would see it that way.
Yeah, I just don't think it would be absurd to put a fee on cigarettes and dedicate it to public school education because we, you know, have drug programs in the school that educate our children. I mean, that would be not absurd to me at all. I mean, that's a part of the educational program. It could be used to fund the police officers who come into the school. It could be a fee very legitimately set up to carry out its purpose and be very tailored toward that particular fee. But by dedicating it to that fund, it would exempt it from the revenue and spending limits. And so those kinds of fees are currently in the revenue and spending limits, and they wouldn't be because of the way you set up all monies. And so there's so many examples of things like that that you could, you know, you could put a fee on vehicle registration and use it to, you know, teach high school kids not to drink and drive or drive recklessly or, you know, whatever. There's so many purposes that you could assess these fees that I think would be completely legitimate. I wouldn't consider that to be an outrageous fee to put something like that on cigarettes or on vehicle registrations. But I do think that by then depositing in that fund, you've done something that's disconnected from the tax increment that you've set up. And then you've set up this fund. So I think you can do both things without being outrageous. I just think that they are disconnected subjects.
I would not agree respectfully, partly because dedicating cigarette tax fee revenue from cigarettes.
You could put a fee on it.
First of all, I don't know how you do that, but if we could find a way, somebody could figure a way to do that and dedicate it to the purposes of this fund, somehow connecting it with, I mean, I understand a safety, you know, substance safety program or something. I'm not sure that's consistent. I wouldn't read that necessarily as consistent with the purposes of this fund. So I had difficulty seeing what you're describing happening. And I guess, I mean, again, we're sitting here trying to predict what somebody could come up with. And somebody will always come up with some argument for something. And I guess all I can say is, I have three responses to this on the single subject grant. Number one, that's not our intent. So, and I think that's important because legislative history matters in measures.
It matters when your provision is vague or the words on the page. I mean, you don't look to intent until you have some vagueness.
Well, I mean, we're sort of arguing a vagueness issue here.
Well, you are.
It's clearly not our intent that happened. Number two is we are using the concept of dedication, which is a process itself that has to take place. And we're interpreting that word as meaning a little bit more than just dumping money into the fund. That dedication has to be legally compliant. Number three, we've actually complied ourselves with our own intended restriction in our own measure by statutorily debrucing the revenues from the in our last section here from the in the dedication provision into this fund. What we're trying to avoid is either closing the fund, or, and perhaps part of the concept of the asserted resolve is we want to leave the fund open to other revenues. We're not trying to say if you want to put other money into this fund, we could rewrite the measure and say you have to comply with all the provisions of the law, et cetera, which sort of address this problem, which we're presumed, as I say, it's our presumption it would have to do that anyway. We certainly don't want to assume that the fund can have both debruced and non-debruced revenue in it, because that creates a strange accounting situation, it would seem to me, though I suppose it's possible. But again, not something consistent with our intent. So again, I would just leave it at this, because I'm beginning to go around a little bit of a circle on this. But I think what we're doing is predicting a possible application of this measure that we frankly don't anticipate and don't intend and don't think would be reasonable. An argument could be made, and Madam Chair, you pretty much just made one, that maybe there is a rational and reasonable way that this can be, that this could be applied in an evasive manner. To me, that's, since it's so far from the way we've tried to design this, I don't think a court would go there. Not that that matters to the title board. The question here is single subject. And the question, I guess, before the board is, by including that paragraph, have we somehow created a second subject by arguably debrucing all kinds of potential funding sources that may or may not even exist without ever having implied or stated anything to that effect in this measure? It could be presumed that if we expected that to happen or wanted that to happen or intended that to happen, we would have somehow implied that was a possibility. We've done everything contrary to that, including ourselves complying with the existing law. So, I mean, from a single subject analysis, I just can't agree that this measure can be viewed as, in addition to creating this fund to be funded by our own graduated, by our own tax increments, we are also opening the door to a patently evasive mechanism as a second subject at this stage. I just frankly can't see that argument. Can we draft around it in another measure? Sure. I mean, you can't break the law. But
I don't think you're breaking the law. I think if you had written it to say tax increment money is deposited in the blah 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 shall be spent without regard, you'd be fine. I think the problem is where you say all monies, and I'm not suggesting you'd be breaking the law by, you know, putting on that kind of a fee. I mean, we see fees dedicated to all kinds of public services. I mean, the DARE program that was run in the schools was funded by court fees. So there's an educational program that was a fee that if you then deposited into here, it would no longer be subject to the Tabor cap of any of the counties or cities or whoever ran the DARE program, because you would have exempted it through a perfectly legal mechanism. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with doing that. I just think if you want to do that, you have to do it in a separate question, because it is not connected to creating a tax increment tax and then depositing it in this fund. It's a different thing.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to do that, then you need different language than
you
have in B and D.
That may answer the question. I mean, we could certainly go back and adjust this language, and because, I mean, it's clearly not our intent to do it. So from a single subject ground, we've sort of gone around this tower a few times.
I'm not meaning to imply you were trying to do anything surreptitious. No, obviously, that wasn't the intent of your measure. But again, you don't get to control that when it's put into law. Somebody else can come in and, you know, establish that fee. And now the way this reads, all monies, I think means all monies.
Okay.
So that's just where I'm on these.
I think I agree. Ready for a motion?
Sure.
All right. I'll move that initiative 2017-18 number 74, that we find that it contains more than one subject and that we consequently lack jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All right. That takes us to
On this, Madam Chair, if I could say, this is obviously the same measure with one additional provision in it, as is 76. So I'm going to assume we're not going to get title on those as well for exactly the same discussion we had. May I ask the board if there are any other concerns that they have? We'll talk about 75, I guess, first, and then 76 in context. That the board would want to raise at this point. In particular, I mean, we could even ask for a rehearing on the other subject, so I'd sort of like to know the basis of any concerns the board might have or questions the board might have.
I mean, that was the only one for me. I don't know if it
was. The difference with 75 is that it allows the residential real estate assessment as well.
75, the only difference with 74 is section, if I can find it.
Is it section 2?
Section 2, which is the Gallagher freeze, which relates to the sustainability issue with the schools. That's everything else is the same. So it's an assessment rate freeze.
Kind of going along the same route that you've brought up a couple times in terms of I may not be excited about my income tax going up, but I sure do like my property tax being frozen, even if it's just for residential. And so are there, by addressing two different types of tax rates and kind of taking them in two different directions, are you raising different reason? Does it create a log rolling type of situation?
Again, that's not the intent, and I don't think it does. The intent is that we want this fund to be both adequate and sustainable. Mm-hmm. And it makes little sense. We want a sustainable and equitable funding system statewide, which this is intended to implement. It doesn't make sense if we are generating revenue, which essentially becomes part of the state share of the public school funding, making an assumption about what a public school finance act would look like. Meanwhile, at the local level, the field is constantly changing and money's draining out the bottom of the fund for one reason or another. And assessment rates are being driven by Gallagher and everything, the Gallagher assessment rate ratios. And everything becomes dependent upon mill levy overrides, and we end up with both inequities and, to some extent, a threat to the sustainability of what we're trying to accomplish. So it's one package. Now, in the other measure we just talked about, we didn't do that, but here we're trying to do it. We're trying to be more complete. This isn't Christmas treeing or log rolling. And, you know, I'm sure there may be any individual voter out there who would like any one part of any particular measure more than another, but that is not, again, the goal or the effort in this measure. I would say they're necessarily and properly connected, using the general language. There's nothing surreptitious about what we're doing. We're stating it, nothing coiled up in the folds, as the case language says. And again, taking the Supreme Court's guidance that I think the title board is supposed to be a bit liberal in its interpretation and not find log rolling or Christmas treeing when it's not really there. And this has a purpose. This has a purpose to make the fund sustainable and workable.
So I move as to initiative number 2017-18, number 75, that we find that it constitutes more than one subject and we lack jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
May I inquire, is the subject you're referring to, just for the record?
Yeah.
The one we discussed with regard to 74.
I mean, I was going to incorporate my comments from the...
Yeah, why don't you do that first?
Why don't we incorporate our arguments and comments from number 74, and then for me personally, it'll be on that. I think we've set other questions that have to do with multiple types of taxes, and we haven't had a problem with that. Those haven't presented the same issues that the all monies language presented for me. So I think we've incorporated everyone's comments into the record. So all those in favor?
Aye.
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 All right. So that takes us to 76.
Same discussion, Madam Chair. It just 76 lowers rather than freezes the assessment rates.
And we'll incorporate our comments from 74. Do you have any other comments? No.
No.
And so with those comments incorporated, I would move that as to initiative 2017-18, number 76, we find that it constitutes more than a single subject and we lack jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
That takes us to 79. Go ahead, Ms. Rainey.
Single subject on 79. This is a purely statutory measure. Same single subject to establish a sustainable and equitable mechanism to fund pre-primary through secondary public schools. And because it's purely statutory,
it's not.
I believe it lacks, excuse me? Oh, I'm sorry. It does not have the provision that we've been, the constitutional provision we've been discussing with regard to the fund.
I disagree that it's purely statutory.
Section two. There is, you're right. The fund, thank you for correcting Ms. Pellegrin. The fund and its operation is purely statutory. There is a constitutional strikeout provision in here to allow us to have the graduated tax. And that is section
two,
which I've now lost.
Two?
Yep.
It should be two if it's not.
It is.
No. Yes, it's two.
So, and again, same proponents on this one and their presence.
Yes, they are.
My concern with the, as to single subject, is as to this constitutional strikeout, whereas the other ones were making an exception to the single rate for purposes of the public school funding, this is eliminating it for all purposes. Is that right?
That's correct.
And that raises a potential concern about whether this is more than one subject. Can you speak to that?
Sure. And that's exactly the question. I'm a little surprised with the other issue, but I expected that question here. Obviously, what we're trying to do is get into a 50% vote issue here. That's not hidden whatsoever, and we're curious as to whether we can do it. We need to eliminate that provision or adopt an exception to it in order to have the tax increments that we're trying to do. The question that's posed, and let me try to answer two questions. One, this is, I think, and this is not a single subject issue, but the 50-55% vote, to me this is a 50% vote because it's a partial repeal. I'll just leave that hanging there for a moment, which is why obviously we did it that way. Now the single subject question is an interesting one that I frankly can argue both sides of, but let me present the sides. I think this is probably one of the first times, and maybe not. You've been here and I haven't over the last several months, but here's what I would suggest to the board, and I do mean this quite sincerely. We have an obstacle to having a constitutional obstacle to having the tax increments. We're trying to eliminate that obstacle. We're using one instrument to do it, which may be fairly blunt. We're taking out the obstacle in this measure. We're doing it for the purposes otherwise expressed in this measure. Can we do it in a more refined and narrow fashion, more directed to our particular measure? Yes, 74 is an example of that. 66 was an example of that. That can be done. I guess the question to the board, and Mr. Roper, I'm going to kind of toss this back to you because I'm interested in the advice to come from the board on this. Does the single subject requirement at this level require us to employ the least or one of the least blunt measures to remove an obstacle that clearly is a direct obstacle to our measure? I mean, I'm not sure that's something that's been argued through and decided as yet. I would suggest that the precision with which we attempt to remove an obstacle that is an obstacle that's clearly one to our measure. It's not just some random constitutional provision out there that we don't like, but the precision with which we address that should not pose single subject concerns. Now, I understand there's an argument on the other side of that issue, but let me posit that one to the board, because I think that's really what we're confronting the board with this effort. Is are we going to be directed to use a more tailored instrument to eliminate an obstacle that is clearly not a random obstacle or a random requirement out there? It's one that's clearly in our way. And does that come within the purview of a single subject concern? So with that, I would really like to hear from the three members of the panel and your thoughts on that.
I didn't even think you could do it with precision, so I'm probably not the one to ask.
You don't think I did it with precision?
I mean, I don't even think 73, given where they landed on, you know, changing the substance and then changing the procedure, the Supreme Court. I'm not sure you can even change it as to your particular measure, let alone do something that's global.
You're referring back to 73?
Yeah. Well, the one that, whichever one it was that changed the way you vote.
Oh, that's 73. You're right. Yeah. I understand.
I think the fact that now it's very difficult to amend the Constitution doesn't affect a single subject analysis. The single subject analysis is still, does this affect more than one subject?
Agreed.
And even though it's easier to amend the Constitution with a straight repeal, which unfortunately in your case has the effect of creating more than one subject, I don't think that our analysis changes. Single subject analysis is still single subject analysis.
I would agree with that. I mean, wherever you come out on this, I would completely agree with Pelican what you said. I think, I mean, it's clear why we're doing this. Mm-hmm. That's beside the point. The question, I think you just stated perfectly, is this a single subject violation because we have been a bit more blunt in removing the obstacle than we necessarily needed to be. Does that create, we clearly have been more blunt than we needed to be in this measure. Does that pose a single subject objection? And that's sort of the question I threw back to you. So I agree completely with your framing of that.
And in my view, it does.
It does, okay.
Because you are getting rid of the restriction on multiple tax rates for all purposes.
Okay.
So
it's blunt. No, I'm not arguing the point with you.
Yeah, and again, we're not trying to dictate how you tailor the measure. We're just looking at, does this strike through that you have in Section 2 create a separate subject from things you're doing in other sections of the bill. And I think I agree that it does, because it does eliminate that one rate requirement for all purposes, which is a separate subject from the rest of the bill.
Well, you're answering the question that I asked you, and you're answering it in the frame I asked it to you in. So no, I appreciate that. I mean, it really, so the single subject analysis does, in the board's view, turn to some degree, and here, meeting that degree, on the question of bluntness of our removal of the obstacle. That's the issue. I mean, frankly, that's the issue we needed addressed with this measure.
So. I mean, I don't even think you need to do it. It would be a measure that comes after this measure, and wouldn't it just override?
Well,
if you're changing it so that now you won't be taxed at one rate.
Well, we could do one and then the other measure.
We could
do two measures.
Why would you need to even do the other measure?
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
It's a subsequent law that will override whatever was...
I would disagree just because it's at the statutory level.
Oh, and because it's a statute.
It's all statute. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Even if it's voter approved, it's statute. It can't override the Constitution.
No. So we could pass the...
You'd have to do it
table, the Tabor strikeout, and then pass our statute.
Yeah, if they were all constitutional, then you'd be okay, arguably.
I think the board's addressed my question.
Ready for a motion?
Sure.
All right. I move that as to proposed initiative 2017-18, number 79, we find that it constitutes more than a single subject and that we consequently lack jurisdiction to set title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. That brings us to the conclusion of the agenda. Anyone dissatisfied with the board's decisions can file a motion for rehearing within 7 days. And the time is 3:52, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thanks.